Good afternoon. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our show today is about the challenges and rewards of gardening in Alaska. Speaking of challenges, when I was preparing for today's show late last week, it was snowing. All around, we've had a really chilly spring. So where does that leave our local gardeners? Are we behind in our growing season? Should we switch up what we're planning to grow? Or what if you're new to gardening and you got seduced by a tomato plant or some strawberries at the hardware store? Now what do you do? Or you've been trying to save money and think maybe eating lettuce out of your own garden might be a good start. Well, where do you begin? Or more seriously, maybe you're thinking about the quality of food you routinely consume or the distance it has to travel to get here. Maybe you're rethinking your carbon footprint when it comes to food. So today's show is for all of you. I hope that we're going to talk about what's new in plants, what's new in culture, and what's new in attitudes about gardening. We've got three terrific guests in the studio to take your questions and also talk about all of this. I'd like to welcome Julie Riley. She's the master teacher of the Master Gardeners at the Cooperative Extension Service. We have Cindy Carnes, a permaculture enthusiast and teacher. And we have Leah Wagner coming all the way down from Palmer. Thanks, Leah, for making the trip. Kind of an expert in seeds and an entrepreneur and a permaculture teacher also.
Yes.
So welcome to you all. And thanks
Thank
for...
Thank you.
This is a busy time of the year for gardeners and permaculture people to get out. And so thanks for giving us an hour of your time. And we're really lucky to have you. So welcome to Hometown Alaska. And I want to throw out our phone numbers because I know there's going to be a few callers who have gardening questions. So... if you want to know how to test your soil or what kind of hardy seeds will do well in Alaska, give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 or send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Julie, I'm going to start with you just off the bat because last Saturday I met up with you at the Spinard Farmers Market and you had coolers full of snow and you had selected some specialty Arctic plants. Well, that was some kind of a joke for us gardeners to appreciate.
Well, I was having fun with the fact that it was snowing on the first day of Farmers Market, you know, with white icicle radishes and snow peas.
Yeah. Right. And some kind of Arctic something else.
Well, I had alpine strawberries.
Alpine
That's what
strawberries,
you're thinking of.
Yeah. And just these two coolers of snow. So I just appreciated that sense of humor. And Leah, I think I bumped into you at the market without realizing it. I was in the booth that had the various seeds in it and packets that are all organized and look kind of designed, all similar designs. So I knew I was in a special place, but I didn't get a chance to talk to you. So, I guess I've been talking to all of you over the last couple days to just get ready for the show. And one of the things Julie said to me, and I invite you to chime in, Leah and Cindy, but Julie said that people coming in to take her classes, they want to grow food. They're not thinking about vegetables or strawberries or flowers. They want to grow food. And I'd like to talk about what that's about.
Well, you know, to me, this is a new phenomena. I've been teaching gardening for over 30 years, and people don't say, you know, I want to learn about vegetable gardening. They say, I want to grow food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just have been pondering where that comes from. I don't know if, you know, if some authors like Michael Pollan, perhaps, have started us thinking about, you know, what we eat, not just about what we grow.
Mm-hmm. But what we put in our bodies. Yeah,
so mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's definitely a trend. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was thinking about the whole food security issue and people thinking, well, we only have, well, I've heard various, you know, 2 or 4 days of food and our food stores are down in Oregon. And I think some people are thinking, maybe something besides grass would be a good idea in case I need my food. So what do Cindy or Leah think about this idea that food is sort of important?
Well, I think it's a very visceral thing in Alaska because we can visually see how sad our food gets here in the middle of winter. Mm. And so no matter whether or not you're a gardener, if you're focused on organics, if you are mindful of these things, you want better food for your family throughout the year. And that's not necessarily the case in the lower 48. You don't see it the same way. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we focus on at Foundroot is giving people a sense of that empowerment and how to grow their own food down to the very seed and have it not cost very much to be healthy, to be chemical free, and to feel as though they can take that type of control over how they eat and also how they approach their food in general.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Cindy?
So I've been getting the same sorts of things. Please teach me how to can. Please teach me how to compost. What do you do with worms? How do you keep them in your house? All those questions. Just teach me. And so I've been trying to rise to that occasion. I know that I'm involved in permaculture, and permaculture is a contraction of permanent and culture. So how do we live in a permanent way so that we're restoring the earth rather than degrading the earth? And I feel like people are feeling the pressure of the looming economic times. The oil, we've used half the oil on the planet, and now, you know, it's hard to get. Even ConocoPhillips is saying that. And climate change. And so those three things are just converging, and people are just kind of feeling the need to take care of themselves. Before the pipeline, we were growing 55% of our, we were importing 55% of our food, and now we're importing 95% of our food.
Wow. A smaller population back then, but still.
But still, it's a percentage.
Yeah. I was thinking that gardening is a little bit like cooking. People have forgotten how.
It's true.
They've been seduced by, you know, letting other people prepare their food. But as we've kind of come up with some health issues related to that, corn syrup and everything, people are paying more attention to what they're actually eating. So, Julie, back to you. What do you think about the health aspect of it? You think that some people are saying, well, I want to know what's going in my mouth.
Absolutely. And the large seed corporations have even picked up on this, and you're seeing new varieties, new cultivars that have, you know, improved amounts of vitamins.
Almost like Wonder Bread. Add the stuff back in that you took out.
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know how long that's going to last. But I see, the new millennium, the year 2000, I see that as kind of a starting point for this interest in growing vegetables in Anchorage, because in the 80s, if you said gardening, it meant flowers.
Uh-huh. That's what people were really thinking. I want my yard to look pretty.
So now, you know, it's really exciting to see this interest in food production. And I think, like Leah mentioned, people want to have control over what they eat and the ability to grow organically and, you know, feel confident and know that there's no pesticides that have been involved in the food that they're eating is really important.
Yeah. Well, we don't have the easiest climate to grow things in. So let's talk a little bit. And by the way, we have links on our website. I've put links to your various, who you represent, Found Root and Permaculture, mm-hmm. and the Cooperative Extension. And one of the things I saw there was the temperatures for when you should plant, or the times when you should plant things. So let's talk a little bit. Let's give people some advice on how to get started if you're really green to this.
Well, temperature is everything. Soil temperature and air temperature and the overall climate in Anchorage, you know, dictates what we can be successful with. So new gardeners, you know, right off the bat need to learn we have cool season vegetables and we have warm season vegetables. And guess what? We do well with the cool season crops.
Right. And that's a kind of a hard lesson to learn because people think I want corn, I want tomatoes, I want cucumbers and, you know, hot peppers. And so unless you've got a greenhouse, you're not really doing some of those things.
You shouldn't be.
No.
you're not going to be doing them successfully.
It's a poor use of space to be doing sweet corns and tomatoes out in the garden because you won't get any food from it. Whereas if you're doing something like cabbage, you can store it, those root crops, all of those things. And if you want to start, there's a lot of vegetables that are very easy to grow. I always encourage people to just grow some greens and radishes. Whether or not you're a salad eater, it will make you feel great about your garden all season long. Those types of things grow great up here.
Mm-hmm. You know what? We had one email come in earlier asking about bolting in radishes. Mm-hmm. And so she just said, what's that about? And what can we tell her? She didn't say whether they were indoors and she's waiting to plant them out, or if it's indoors, it's just not enough light, right?
Well, you want to plant all your root crops directly in the ground. Roots don't like to be moved. You want to be mindful of what type or what part of the plant you're actually eating. The biggest thing with something like a radish is just giving it enough space. So making sure that you thin out those plants so they're not crowded. Think about how big you want your plant to be, mm-hmm. the actual root part that you're going to be eating, and make sure that you give it enough space. And that would be the first step.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's also, I want to just add to that, is if you want to just plant the seeds in a hurry and just plant them out, take your scissors and eat those greens. Just thin them out that way, and the greens are pretty good.
So people aren't thinking, oh, I got to go in with my tweezers now.
Right.
And thin this out. Yeah. I like, sometimes I've seen this and done it, just thrown like mesclun mix or something like that. Just throw it into a box and then cut like a whole corner off and make a salad out of it, you know. But really, Julie and I have had a funny conversation about kale, because what you said years ago, you couldn't talk anybody into eating or growing kale.
In recent history, you know, 7 years ago, you couldn't sell kale at the farmer's market very easily.
And now, I think it's almost like since kale chips made it to the internet, suddenly kale is like a hot item. And I've had such success with kale. I can't ruin kale. I mean, it's one of those things that's just happy to grow here, I guess.
Mine even came back the next year.
Wow, perennial kale.
I know. It was amazing.
That's not supposed to happen.
No, it's not.
Although maybe we have different perennials in this cold climate that we don't know about. Yeah. So let's see. If someone is just wanting to start, would you recommend containers? What would you guys say? And the permaculture view of things, what would that be? I mean, suppose you just bought a house and you moved in and you're thinking, okay, I want a garden. I don't want to put bad things down, but I really want to get yield, and I want to get rid of the weeds, maybe the orange hawkweed or, you know, things that are getting really aggressive. Let's hear some advice from, let's start with you, Leah.
Well, Cindy and I are eyeing each other because we both know what we would do. We'd throw down a bunch of cardboard newspaper and cover up all those weeds. Don't fight them. Don't try and pull them. Mm-hmm. Just cover them. And in permaculture, that's referred to as sheet mulching, or a lot of people have heard of lasagna composting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure what I do. And you don't know what was there before. You don't know if they had pesticides or whatever. And I grew up in Fairbanks, and I was taught there weren't any worms, but contrary, I found out this week there are definitely worms in Anchorage, in the Anchorage area. So those worms will then come up and eat the weeds under the cardboard, and then they'll start eating the cardboard, and then they'll come into your garden.
So you basically put a layer of cardboard or newspaper down, and then you put dirt on top of that? Or compost?
I put manure and some grass clippings and some newspaper and leaves from your fall, you know, if you can put that in there, and you can plant directly in that because that's composting. The sun will heat it and it will heat up give the seeds a little warmth right there.
Mm-hmm. So what's a more traditional approach, Julie?
Well, I want to address your comment about container gardening, and I think that the interest in container vegetable gardening has just mushroomed in recent years, and because not everybody has land or a yard. So containers, you know, just about everything can be grown in a container if you match up the vegetable with the size of the container. If you have a, you know, big enough container, then you don't have to be so concerned. But if you have plants growing in a container that are too small, you end up having to water every day or twice a day, and nobody wants to do that.
So be mindful of a large enough container.
And this is not something that's posted on our website, but I will get it up so that if people are interested in container gardening, they can see, you know, size and size of container and vegetable and even down to cultivar.
Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh. At our last Permaculture Guild meeting, we had a Don Wood, who is a gardener. He took his old dog food bag and filled it with dirt. He's planting potatoes in his old dog food bag. And that's very permaculture. You don't have any waste. So you use everything at least three times before you throw it away. So he's planting potatoes in his dog food.
I could do that. I have a dog and I have dog food bags.
Yeah, there you go.
One of the things I noticed when I was reading about permaculture was that you need to get a benefit from it. It's not that you just do this without a benefit. And I thought that was interesting. I mean, it's kind of common sense that you don't want to put in a lot of energy and not get anything out of it, but I never heard it stated like that before. And I mean, I'd like to hear a little bit about that from the permaculture people.
Well, it's exponential, actually. So that's a huge element of permaculture and why a lot of people are willing to give it a shot, is that you do put in a lot of inputs in the beginning. So that might be a financial input. It might be actual materials, but most of all with permaculture, it ends up being a labor input. And so there's a lot of that at the beginning, but the idea is that it's going to serve you endlessly over time because you're using systems that take care of your soil, take care of your land, your space, your family, your community. It's a design system, so it works with all of these different elements to make sure that you're actually well taken care of in the end. So a lot of perennials, a lot of trees, a lot of systems that work together, putting similar plants together, things that work simultaneously, a really nice, beneficial, mutually beneficial relationship.
Hmm, interesting. If you've just joined us, we're having a gardening show, and it's a little nippy outside, but it's at least not snowing. And, you know, I saw a little sun peeking through there. So if you've just joined us and you've got gardening questions, today's a great day. Maybe you want to know, can I start now, now that it's not snowing? Or when should I start? Give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. Or send an email to hometownatalaskapublic.org. In the studio with me, we have Cindy Carnes, a permaculture teacher. We have Leah Wagner, who I guess you're an entrepreneur, a seed entrepreneur, but it sounds weird to say it that way, but also a permaculture teacher, and Julie Riley with the Cooperative Extension Service. And so we've got it covered here, folks. let's see, what should we do next?
Well, I have one more thing I'd like to say about container gardening, and that is Rime. It's a really thin, it looks like, if you're a seamstress, it's a interfacing, it looks like.
Okay.
Julie's waving some around right here.
Oh, she brought show and tell here.
Yeah. You know what? We live 2 miles up a mountain out by Eagle River, and that really helped us last year. We put some bendable willow sticks over our garden boxes, and then we put Rime on top of that, and we left it on. It looked like Conestoga wagons. Yeah. But it really did help.
What does this do? Does it keep wind out? Does it keep okay, it's a wind protector.
Yeah, and that, you know, that is one of the best things that it does. You can get a few degrees of frost protection, but keeping the cool breeze off makes a huge difference when you're hardening off your transplants, but also in the young vegetable garden, if you've, got raised beds that are made of lumber, you can just staple it to the sides of the boxes. But it's, its generic name is floating row cover. So it's supposed to rise up as the plants grow. But in most locations, the wind will carry it off if it's not weighted down.
Mm-hmm. And of course, folks can't see it. We're only talking about it. But it's kind of like gauze. It's kind of soft and pliable. And is it expensive? Where do you find it? The Home Depot? Is it everywhere?
I got it. Mine at Mill and Feed. It's pretty. It's worth it though.
Well,
I think
we paid
$50.
It.
Yeah,
you can reuse it
if you take care of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If it doesn't come in, if it doesn't get too dirty, it will last for years and years and years. And it is harder to find than it should be. I don't know. Whoever developed this should have had a lesson in marketing because Rime is the brand name,
right.
But there is no good generic term. People don't use the word floating row cover.
So, it just doesn't roll off your tongue.
Well, so you find it in garden centers and greenhouses listed as a garden blanket, and they don't, put it with the mulch, that's used on the top of the soil for warming or weed control. It's put in a separate place, but
You mean in the store?
In the stores, and you can definitely, mail order it in, but you need it now, so you can find it locally, and if you need a lot of it, you can buy rolls of it.
Right.
Is it R-E-M-A-Y?
Yes, Rime? I think so.
But then floating row cover.
Yeah, or just row cover. It's it's common to find online, but usually you do have to buy a whole roll of it, and I think it's a pretty nominal investment considering that you can reuse it if you buy thick enough material. It comes in different thicknesses.
Oh, so like different weights.
Yeah, pretty much. We tend to use the heavier weights, but you don't want to make sure it's not too heavy because you want to make sure that light and that water can penetrate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common in farms around the world. It's just not as common in home garden, and it's because you don't usually need it. But in Alaska, we do. And so there's a demand here that they don't have other places to be using it in the home garden.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I've become aware of is the cold temperatures in our soils. We might have different microbes working here. And can we talk a little bit about the microbial community in our soil and the temperature and how that affects it? Is that something the home gardener needs to know?
I think a home gardener should have a soil thermometer. And anybody who's got a greenhouse or a high tunnel or you know, even as trying to beat the season, needs a minimum maximum thermometer for the air. And that is hard to find, too, locally.
So we just haven't progressed quite. I mean, I don't mean to say it that way, but I mean, people are identifying the needs, but maybe the marketplace hasn't caught up with the desire for those needs to be met a little bit.
Yeah, I think that I think maybe Julie's seeing what the stores just have to catch up mm-hmm. with everybody wanting to grow food suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real issue. And we just need to point people in the right direction and
talk
tell
to,
those businesses.
Talk to our businesses, yeah.
Right.
We've got a caller, so I'm going to invite Matt onto the show. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're calling in from Wasilla?
Yes, and it's sunny and nice out here today.
Oh, we're jealous. Well, it's not nice here. It's not snowing, but it's a little cloudy and cool. That's the way I'd put it. But yeah. Anyway, are you out in your garden?
No, I'm not out in my garden right now, but we've been out every night after dinner. And I have a question about raspberries.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. We have sort of an east-facing slope, and it's been a great raspberry producer over the years. We've gotten a lot of really good, you know, Doris Dearborn raspberries. But lately, the last couple of years, it's just been invaded by grass and fireweed really bad. And I've noticed the plants becoming more and more stunted. And the berries production has really fallen off, I'd say, in the last 2 years or so. What should we do?
Hmm. Who wants to jump in?
I'll tell you what I'm doing with my raspberries.
Okay.
I'm going by Kaladi Brothers and picking up their coffee grounds, and I'm distributing coffee grounds as much as I can on top of my beds, and then I'm putting leaves on top of that. So my raspberries are being fed by nitrogen, which is the coffee grounds, and carbon, which are the leaves, and I just keep doing that. And I throw worms in there, and that's what I'm doing. What are you guys doing?
Well, I think that, you know, raspberries are very sensitive to moisture, too. So I'm concerned about your slope, given the competition with the other plants. Perhaps that's why they're not thriving. So I don't know if you have a different area where you could, you know, reset some of those part of the bed. Try what Cindy has suggested here. But, you know, it's hard to fight grass. And if, you know, if it's one of our native grasses, Calum agrostis, the blue joint reed grass, it's a, you know, that's a plant that's going to win. You know, if it's coming in with the fireweed, I'm thinking that may be what you have. Or you might have something that has been brought in. But the native blue joint reedgrass is very, very aggressive. You know, it grows here naturally, and it's gonna win.
I would give it some space.
It is winning.
That's why you're calling.
Yeah, make sure those plants get some space.
Is black plastic an option, like between the rows of raspberries? Will that will a heavy layer of like some commercial product that would block out the light but still allow the moisture to get down, is that an option?
How about burlap instead?
Burlap.
Yeah, you can get it for free at the coffee roastery. It'll be free for one. And two, it actually does biodegrade. It takes a long time, but it's a nice thick layer. It's natural. You're not putting plastic, any sort of chemicals within your space. It'll help smother those ones. But you may have to actually get in there with some elbow grease and do some amendments in the soil and actually pull out the space around the raspberries themselves. Give them that space. Give them that nourishment, and then block everything else so it doesn't come back around.
So you're saying weed? You would weed?
I would weed. Yeah, uh-huh. I would weed around the raspberries.
We've been weeding.
Yeah, but make sure those pathways are covered so then those weeds aren't coming back through. So you want to make sure to suppress it. So only weed as much as you have to. Cover the rest in something like a burlap. You could use cardboard as well. I think burlap would hold up better. And then actually weed out around the raspberries, and then something like the coffee, and mm-hmm. that mulch would be really, really nice for them.
So nobody's talking about fertilizer here. I mean, that's a form of natural fertilizer, but
well, you're you know, that's Cindy's reference, you know, was coffee grounds for nitrogen and mm-hmm. leaves
which for
are
carbon.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which is kind of a natural kind of composting and putting the nutrients back in the
goat
soil.
Goat manure is good.
Goat manure.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do you...
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, okay. Well, we hope you do. We hope you turn the corner on this.
Yeah. Okay, so long.
Thanks for calling, Matt. Bye-bye. Let's see. What do I? Well, I know I have one question, Julie, and I mentioned it. I have to get the worms on the show about the mounds in the people's lawns. And just before I came in, a friend here mentioned it to me. She said, "All I'm seeing is worms, worms, worms," and my neighbors too. So, what's the story behind the sudden arrival of worms?
Well, you know, if you're growing food, you know, you welcome
those worms.
We do have the common nightcrawler. And it can create, you know, great big middens or casting mounds. And you see them in the spring and maybe in the fall. And I have seen them so numerous that almost every square inch has one of these little volcanoes. Yeah, a little mound. And
they actually just, are they pushing up the earth or they're actually just making their own little mound of casings?
You know, they live in burrows and they come up to grab organic material to, you know, to take down and to feed. Or if the soil gets too saturated with moisture, they have to come up to breathe. So it's usually a spring phenomena and a fall phenomena. They go quite deep. I mean, the night crawlers go quite deep in the ground in the wintertime, but we're getting reports that some of the worms that are used in vermiculture for composting with worms, the red wigglers, that they are also surviving winter temperatures.
It's true. I've seen it in my own property. I thought that they would die. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I thought they survived. I didn't know they died.
Well, none of the earthworms are indigenous to Alaska.
No earthworms are indigenous. No. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that either. Yeah.
And so, you know, they, in other parts of the country, they've changed the ecosystems in forests by their populations becoming so large, or with exotic species moving in, that they, you know, they change the natural duff layer in the forest. So there's been quite a bit of research on them. But as gardeners, I don't know, as somebody who's has an entrepreneurial spirit, might start collecting them and selling them to gardeners over Craigslist. I don't know.
Oh, that's already happening.
Yeah, I think I've seen worms for sale.
Oh yeah. I sell them.
Yeah,
sure.
The red wigglers. But are you out collecting them? Are you out collecting them on the lawn?
You know, I should have been, but I was putting them in my raspberries.
That's great. So these mounds are not damaging anything. People probably just don't like them because they don't know what they are.
Well, it would be hard to play croquet or walk across the lawn in heels. But if you know, you can rake them down. You could, if your lawn has thatch and you're gonna go through the dethatching process or core aeration, you know, that will break them down and flatten them out. You can let your grass grow longer to hide them, which probably would be better for the grass anyways, to have more leaf surface.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's a permaculture solution? You wouldn't even consider it a problem?
Non-issue.
It is an issue because in permaculture, you don't, unless you have a natural place where grass grows, you don't have lawns.
Right, there aren't lawns in permaculture.
Right, yeah. Right. So if you're going to grow something edible.
Mm-hmm.
Mint. Or something yummy on your that you can eat.
Mm-hmm. So Leah, you're up in Palmer. Do you have a permaculture environment going where you are now?
We have a rented piece of land that we live on, and in that space we started our garden last year. It's small, it's about 500 square feet, and then we have another fenced-in space that we inherited, and that one's probably at least three times the size of that. And so we'll be working both of those spaces this year, but we also do a lot of wildcrafting and also contribute to other people's gardens. We're not trying to produce every single thing ourselves in our own space, but the things that we have worked on, we've done permaculturally. And so we sheet mulch both of those spaces. We utilize the natural landscape, doing our strawberries on the hill that was already there. You try and use what you have. So it's not just about using permaculture systems, but also not creating more waste. And so we inherited a very strange little cold frame, and so we bought greenhouse plastic for it, and we used that, and I built some beds and made it work for our needs, and just kind of working with the space that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to invite another caller onto the show. Hi, Gordon.
Hey, hello. How are you doing today?
Well, welcome to Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
For Julie. Hi, Julie. It's G. Gordon.
Hey, G.
The soil temperature is real cold, and as you know, I do 95% of flowers. And all my main gardens, the amount I have, they're between 38 and 40 degrees, and they're about 10 inches deep. You know, they're all built to be at least 16 inches, but it's still cold. And, of course, my greenhouse is full, everything, and I started early this year. That was crazy. But the main question is, how close can I get to 50, and how deep do I have to go to have, if I have 10 inches at 45 degrees, is that good enough to go with my flowers?
Boy, you are stumping me here. I looked up all sorts of temperature regimes. I have air temperatures for flowers, but I don't have any soil temperatures for flowers.
I use my compost 20-incher to check out my soil temperatures, and I've been doing it every other day for a week. And yesterday, my highest was 40 degrees, and my lowest was 38 degrees, except for my south side that you know, and that's, my south side is 50 degrees, but that's because I got the south sun and I got the water pipes right there.
Okay, start planting there. Start planting there.
It's already planting, and all my oriental poppies and my malvas and my tulips, my tulips should be blooming here any day.
Okay, so how about some ornamental vegetable growing, Gordon? Lettuce and spinach and onions, those would make a nice border, and the seed will germinate at 35 degrees. So you could do any of that.
And you could eat it, too.
It's pretty. You know, my mother used to plant parsley and pansies as a border to her vegetable garden, and it was beautiful. So the pansies could go out. Now they can take really cool temperature. Spinach.
Julie and I have had this conversation a number of years, and I'm 40 years up here and retired heavy construction. And when I retired, my biggest need is beauty and color, something that Anchorage or Alaska has a hard time producing. Mm. And so my thing in life around where I live is bringing multiple colors to the neighborhood. So people can enjoy
Okay, I'm going to make a recommendation, Gordon. I'm going to say, get the soil up to 50 degrees, and you can use clear plastic to do that.
Right. I was just going to, that was next, because I've got clear plastic here, and I was thinking of spreading it on the garden.
So do that. Don't put it down where you have your perennials, though. And then my office does have a list of flowers that can withstand air temperatures to 30 degrees, and the list is quite long.
Okay. Well, I'm building my hardening off area right now as we speak, and my greenhouse is all full. They want to be planted now. I got dahlias the size of small trees.
Hey, Gordon, thank you. We're going to move on. Thanks so much for calling in, and good luck with your strategy here. I think you got some good ideas.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Gordon. I wanted to ask permaculturists, do you have any suggestions that you would throw out?
I definitely do. I love nasturtiums. Mm-hmm. So nasturtiums, they're colorful. And you can eat the flowers, and you can eat the leaves, and you can...
And they can take cold temps?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And how about you, Leah?
Yeah, we sell nasturtiums, calendula, and chamomile as our edible flowers this year. And I always recommend, if you're going to do something beautiful, it's nice to be able to eat it as well. And so
that's great.
I definitely focus on those edible flowers. And most of the ones that you'll find up here can handle those really cool temperatures.
Okay.
Yeah, little Johnny jump-ups, too. They're really good in salads.
And bachelor's buttons. There's a lot.
So there's a lot you can do. Well, you've been listening to Hometown Alaska. We're talking about gardening. We've had Julie Riley, Leah Wagner, and Cindy Carnes in the studio with us. And we'll be back after a very short break. This is Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage. Thank you.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're talking about gardening, and we've been taking some questions from callers. I've got Julie Riley from Cooperative Extension here with me, Leah Wagner from Found Root Seeds, and Cindy Carnes, a permaculture teacher. And we've been lately talking about what flowers can grow in cold, but we thought at the break, we said, what should we do when we come back? And we decided, let's talk about what you can plant now. And we'll work our way to the seeds. So go ahead, Julie. What's on your mind?
I like to teach that you don't have to plant the entire garden in one day.
That's how I do it. One very long, tiring day.
So I have a list of, you know, early crops and early crops and late season crops. So the, you know, our traditional planting day or weekend is Memorial Day weekend. So that is upon us. So we've kind of lost our early window here, but anything that you grow from seed, I mean, is protected. If the soil temperature is not warm enough, you know, it won't germinate and grow. But it is, you know, if the weather, you know, gets down to 28, it's going to be okay in the ground.
But what about things that are going to, when the earth finally warms up and it starts to germinate, but it only gets 2 weeks to grow or something like that? You know, I mean, the growing season part of it. But we have long days, so that compensates.
Oh, we've got so many vegetables that will do well in our cool season.
So not to worry. Let's name some things for people.
Well, I mentioned those radishes and greens earlier. If you've started any of your brassicas, like your cabbage, kale, Brussels sprouts, any of that inside, you can start hardening those off, which means putting it out for just a small period, a little bit more each day, getting it acclimated to the outside temperature. That can go in. If you haven't started those, depending on the maturity time, you might be able to start those now. Something like kale, you could direct seed. Just depends on how long of a season it needs. We sell one cabbage called Early Jersey Wakefield. It's a very fast, fresh-eating cabbage. That's something that you could actually direct seed right now. Peas can go in. All those root crops, it takes about 3 weeks for carrots and parsnips to germinate, so they'll be in there for a little while, but don't fear, they're coming. Mm-hmm. The only thing you have to worry about is anything tender if we get another hard frost. Those little sprouts, if they start to sprout and then it gets very cold, they will die. And so something like Rime, or a lot of people will use milk jugs with the bottoms cut off, something like that, putting it over anything that's tender. So if you're putting out something like a nasturtium and you're a little concerned about it, giving it a little bit of protection. Also, if you're in a place like Palmer where it's very windy.
It's windy there.
Those little plants are pretty fragile, and so it might not be the cold, but just that outside experience that
drying even.
Yeah. Exactly.
How about you, Cindy? What's on your agenda? Your garden look like right now?
Well, it's a mess right now. We had that snow, and so it's not very good. And I have, we're putting together, of course, permaculture is about using what you have. And so we've been cutting our own cottonwood and making planks. And so we've built the several boxes. We have a couple more to go. And so last year was our first year in those raised cottonwood boxes. And that soil temperature is warm already, and if I had time, I would be out there planting right now, mm-hmm. putting my little seedlings in and Rime on top.
Mm-hmm.
I am one of the strange people who like to experiment with strange things. I have a very cool microclimate, and I have my little corns, and they're about 8 inches high inside. I'm going to plant corn on my microclimate, and what happens is I get those little corns that you can buy in a little jar, those little pickled corns, and I love them. So
it's good with Asian food.
Exactly.
That's an experiment. I mean, I remember when we had some hot summers here and people were trying to grow corn, and they did successfully grow some corn.
Yeah. Well, I learned a long time ago, you never tell a gardener they can't do something because they will find a way.
That's right. The microclimate is the way. Yeah.
So do you have a favorite variety of corn?
No, I did Denali seed last year, and so I think that's what I have started again this year. But
Now let's talk seeds a little bit, because Denali seed sounds like it's an Alaska seed company.
I think Leah knows more about that.
Okay.
Yeah, they're great. They've worked with the University of Alaska for a long time. I believe it's like a 30-year company. They've been around for a really long time, mm-hmm. supporting gardeners in the area. They grow open pollinated seeds similar to what we grow. And they also sell...
Tell me what open pollinated
means. Oh, yeah. So open pollinated is traditional breeding methods. So the difference between open pollinated seeds and hybrid seeds is that you can collect the seeds from those open pollinated seeds. All heirlooms are open pollinated seeds, but not all open pollinated seeds are heirlooms. Heirlooms are just those seeds with a story. So they're very old seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So Denali has a great selection of all of that. They do sell hybrid seeds as well, and a lot of classic varieties that people grow up here. We are a little bit more experimental. We have a lot of newly bred varieties, and we're also looking for more obscure varieties. Mm-hmm. We're doing our own trials and testings, and we have a smaller selection, but everything that we sell is open pollinated. Mm-hmm. So our main focus is getting people to collect those seeds for themselves and actually completing that full circle of sustainability and self-reliance.
I'm going to throw out our numbers just because people might have questions about seeds, and I forgot to do it when we came back. If you've got questions about anything related to gardening, your soil temperatures, seeds, give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Julie, back to you, because you were letting me know.
So Denali Seeds is now bestcoolseeds.com.
Oh, I didn't know.
So you can't go to the garden center or greenhouse and purchase Denali seeds anymore. You go online. And Reg Yapel, who's the owner of the company, used to have my job back in the 70s.
He used to be the cooperative extension horticulture agent?
Oh. He did.
So he knows what he's doing is one way, something you're telling us. When I go to buy seeds, you know, you can walk into the grocery store and see just stacks and stacks of them. Or you can go to, you know, maybe Mill and Feed and see different varieties. And to me, they've all been the same. So I'm a pretty uneducated person. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, because I think there's a lot of people like me that might not, have as much education. So I know you just kind of went through it, Leah, but is there another approach that you can kind of offer here to somebody who thinks, why can't I pick up my peas at the grocery store? They've got the stacks out there. What's the difference?
Okay, so seed buying 101.
Yeah.
First, mm-hmm. It's very variety specific. So that's why Julie asked Cindy what variety it is, because we trialed 4 different corn varieties last year, and it has to do with their maturity date. And for me, open pollinated is very important, because if I find a corn that works, I want to be able to collect those seeds, get those seeds adapted to my climate, and be able to continue growing out that corn. So that's why it's important for me personally. And so if that's something that's important to you, then look for open pollinated seeds. Look for those maturity dates. We don't sell anything unless it can handle a hard frost that's over 90 days. And this year we're running even shorter than that. So watch those maturity dates. Make sure that it actually can grow in Alaskan climate. Inverse yourself on what grows those hot weather crops versus those cool weather crops. We do great with roots, greens, brassicas, alliums, all those onions, etc. But there is some nitty gritty to it, and that's why FoundRoot's so public. We go to the farmers markets and we will talk gardening for hours. People call me, people email me. We are constantly fielding gardening questions. And so that's one of the benefits of actually buying from a local company, is that we can troubleshoot things with you. We'll ask you about your zone. We'll ask you about what your space is like. I had the fortune of talking to people all over Alaska this past winter and troubleshooting their shady, wet soils and figuring out what's actually going to work for their space. So know your vegetables, look at those maturity dates. If you want to be able to collect the seeds, make sure it's open pollinated. And then lastly, get it from a reputable company. So if you're not going to get it from us, get it from someone else who has ethical practices and is going to be giving you the best bang for your buck. Really good seed, high germination rates, and something that will actually grow for your area.
And the only way to really know is to try the seed, and I mean to develop a relationship with a provider, I guess. I mean, what's an unethical seed practice?
I personally wouldn't buy from a company that's selling GMO seeds. Mm-hmm. That's something that I take into consideration. I'm coming from a permaculture organic perspective. If that's not where you're coming from, won't be as important to you. But I won't buy companies that are affiliated with selling large chemical fertilizers. That's not ethical to me. If it's coming from really far away, I mean, there's definitely large corporations that are buying their seeds overseas and selling them here. Mm-hmm. Talk about irrelevant to Alaskan gardens.
Well, that was a good answer to my question. I'm going to go to the phones. We've got a caller. Hi, Ann. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi. I was wondering what squash, a storage squash that I can plant this summer and store over the winter. I was wondering what kind of squash, winter squash, grows best in Alaska.
All right, we'll toss it out to our experts.
Well, that's a tough one because many of the winter storage squash are photoperiod sensitive, and they don't make flowers when they should be. And the acorn squash is notorious for this. Growers are doing it. The university really hasn't had many trials, although up in Fairbanks, I don't know when you were last up there, Cindy. I'm seeing in my mind as like a sweet mama type of squash, but...
I don't bother to try them down here. I just go get them from John Dart, who is growing them in Manly Hot Springs with the hot springs up there. And he sells at the Anchorage Farmer Markets now. So
I will have to tell you, I bought $400 worth of storage squash from him last year.
See, I did 100. Yeah, that's really, really good.
Wow, that's a recommendation. Yeah. Put your money where you're...
Yeah. People are actually growing winter squash in Palmer very successfully. They usually do it in a high tunnel. The problem with winter squash is actually not so much the cold, but rather the length of the season. So it takes a long time for those to ripen. But an orange kabocha squash has been very successful. But I would look for small varieties. So something that either has a very small plant habit or something that has a small winter squash. So something the size of an acorn. You're not going to get a huge gargantuan pumpkin here, unfortunately, which I love squash more than all other vegetables. So this is something that I'm actively working on. But we'll be trialing those kabochas. And then I got some seeds. Unfortunately, I don't know the name off the top of my head. But I bet if you sent them an email, they might be kind enough to share with you. I got some seeds from Allie at Chugach Farms. Mm-hmm. And they have successfully been growing winter squash in Chickaloon. Mm. So it's definitely possible.
All right. Did that answer your question, Ann?
Where is a guy from Manly? Where does he sell his winter squash? Which farmer's market in Anchorage?
He was at the South Farmer's Market, but he's on Facebook, John Robert Dart, and you can ask him any questions. He's always on there. So, yeah.
Okay, John Robert Dart?
Yep.
But as Leah mentioned, there is quite a bit of winter squash that's happening in the valley. And they show up at farmers markets, so I guess I should be taking notes on this. But it's harder than growing zucchini and yellow crookneck.
Right, and it just depends on your microclimate. You can grow almost anything if you have the right microclimate.
Right, and has anybody mapped the microclimates in Anchorage, Julie?
At a broader level, yes. I mean, you can. No. We got microclimates and we got zones. So I guess what we have is a zone map for Anchorage. But the microclimate in your own space, would be what side of the house it is. You know,
affected
where are the trees?
Location.
Right. Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to take this question. We got an email, and it goes to kind of your situation. We love our neighbors' trees, but they give our 9-year-old garden limited sunlight. We'd like to have a successful garden. What do you recommend? Is there an answer when the trees are blocking the sunlight?
Have you spoken to the neighbors yet?
That's a very good question.
This is an opportunity to negotiate.
Yeah. I the greens do well with only 4 hours of direct sunlight. So, the salad garden would be the way to go. I mean, the other problem with trees is that they suck all the moisture out of your garden. Yeah. So it would be difficult to do a no-till garden if, the tree roots are invading, the garden space. But I would, stay away from, beans and outdoor tomatoes that have cold-sounding names like Glacier and Siberian. But go with a salad garden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about anybody else? Cindy?
I talk to the neighbors and see if you can negotiate something that they like to grow in your garden so that you would have a trade-off with them.
Mm-hmm. You can take the tree down and I'll give you...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can contribute this square of my garden for you, or you could come over and garden or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. People aren't talking to their neighbors anymore, and that's something that I think is really, really important. Mm-hmm. Building community, sharing. My neighbor wanted to grow in her greenhouse tomatoes, and and we were going to grow potatoes, and so we just made a trade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the conversation is, you know, I think that's one of the aspects of permaculture. Not everybody has to have every tool. You can mm-hmm. share it, so it becomes a little more affordable, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe these connections, you make these connections that make community a little bit easier.
Right. So find out who's taking out a sidewalk in your neighborhood and bring those concrete chunks, and you can make squash grow, perhaps, with the concrete right there in your garden.
Making it warm.
Yeah.
Holding in the heat.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Julie, I'm looking across at your sign that says, don't till or walk on your soil when wet. So let's talk. Do we have a particularly wet year, or are we out of the woods yet?
Well, last night I had my first organic food gardening class at the Alaska Botanical Garden, and I had somebody in the class up in Bear Valley in Anchorage that had snow on the ground yet. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's just such a wide range of microclimates like you mentioned. So, you know, what I brought here is this chunk of clay.
Oh.
I don't know if you could hear that
sound
drop.
Sound effects.
You know, it didn't break apart because you just cannot work or walk on a soil that, you know, is silty. Or heavier, you know, if it's not a sandy soil, you should not be doing anything to it if it's you know, wet,
uh-huh.
because you'll ruin the structure.
Uh-huh. How about permaculture people? What are you thinking?
Oh, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Exactly what you're right in line there.
Yeah.
Okay, let it drain, let it dry out. Okay,
yeah.
Mind
yeah.
your patience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, be patient. You know, put something in a pot somewhere if you really have to get your hands in dirt.
Observe and interact is one of the first principles. Observe, and if you're not gonna do much for your soil if you're walking on it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the permaculture principles, because there's kind of a set body of knowledge here. What do we date permaculture to? I mean, was it the 70s, Leah, did you say?
Yeah, Cindy mentioned 78 was
78.
When it really got popularized.
Mm-hmm.
And people started writing books about it. And
uh-huh, and started writing books. And it was a university guy, Bill Mollison, started it, and his student, David Holmgren. And David came up with 12 permaculture principles, and Mollison came up with 30. And the reason why nobody knows what permaculture is because when you take my class, I'll say, okay, at the end of the course, I want you to tell me what permaculture is. So everybody has their own definition.
Mm-hmm.
So, should I just list them?
Well, let's talk about a few. The ones that you think, you don't have to go 1 through 12.
Okay,
but
what
are some of the key ones that are sort of, you know, changing? They're significant in changing the way you behave.
Mine is produce no waste.
Uh-huh.
And so I just try not to buy anything that I have to throw away. So we have a composting toilet. Everything goes down there. All our cardboard, all our junk mail, everything goes down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a core part of who I am.
Kind of a principle to live by.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Liv? Is there one of those principles that is really significant for you, or is it a body that you just kind of embrace?
One thing that really stands out for me in my permaculture education was the idea of noticing the boundaries and noticing the borders. And that's kind of a strange concept to latch onto. It took me a while to really understand it, but it's really relevant in your home space, but also just in life in general and how you approach things, to not ignore those areas where spaces meet. So if you're talking about the kitchen garden, for us, it's next to the house, so we're able to use that border between the house and our land and use that warmth for the kitchen garden. On the border of the kitchen garden and the fence line, we're putting in alliums, so we're actually blocking the grass that's on the land out by utilizing a food, and also moose tend to not like those alliums, and so it's also a block there.
Don't eat here, moose.
Yeah. This is not for you. Mm-hmm. The forest edge line around the house is where we're planting rhubarb, and so those are how you deal with it in food, but also just noticing the way things can interact and the way that things meet. And that's really how I came into seeds, was that there was this open space in terms of my food production where I was having to buy something every year. And I didn't want to do that anymore. And I also was buying a lot of things that weren't relevant to where I was living. And so there was this space and this edge where my food came out of the ground and then it was done, but it's not done. And so that's where seeds come in for me. That was another border, another edge for me.
Mm-hmm. I know I was looking at how do you say, Gaia's Garden?
Mm-hmm.
I picked that up and was reading that. It's called A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture. And I picked up the borders and other things like, you know, walkways through. Don't have walkways through. You're wasting the opportunity to grow something there. Another idea was these key gardens.
Keyhole gardens.
Keyhole
yeah.
gardens. So you kind of walk in and you can reach everything. I guess that's kind of the
mm-hmm.
concept.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I noticed was the patterns. Like, they talked about the way leaves grow. You know, you've got the big stem and then the smaller branching, and that you could organize your whole garden that way, because then your little footpath is actually just leading you to anyway.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
You know, for Julia, I want to ask you, you've been in the gardening world for so long. Are these new ideas to you, or are they sort of repackaged a little bit? And I mean, I don't know, how different is it from what you know and tell people?
There's always something new, right? To me right now, you know, new is vegan gardening. You know, not using any animal waste products or byproducts. The Sustainable Agriculture Conference in Fairbanks this spring, their featured speaker was a vegan gardener. I didn't know that permaculture went back to the 70s because it was definitely not mainstream then, because that's when I was in horticulture school. But, you know, we've had square foot gardening. We've had John Jevons and his double digging method. And so there's always
something new. Some new approach. Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, I've seen the spiral garden. Does that come from permaculture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mimicking natural systems. So we have one spiraling space and then we have another branching space. And those keyholes are just maximizing that space. So what you do is you create a main pathway and then just enough pathway that you need to get into the space and be able to reach everything, as you said. So mm-hmm. we're just trying to create more fluid spaces, and your home can be organized in the same way, not making it so hard-edged.
And your life can be organized in the same way if you just figure it out that way, design it.
When I was Googling around and sort of reading about permaculture, there was a book I found that was sort of how to apply a permaculture to your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly.
So
it's not just about gardening. It's just gardening is just a part of permaculture.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I also wondered whether it was, you know, I have of your age groups here, we're spread out. We have Leah, you're probably the youngest person here. I don't know how old you are. Cindy, you're, you know, a little bit older. Julia, a little bit older. And I'm just sort of, it's not that young people are particularly attracted to this, like it's the new wave of gardening. You wouldn't say that because you've been there and...
Well, I don't know. I think that the philosophy maybe attracts more to young people than older folks, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
Yeah. I this is making me think of a conversation Julie and I had, which was growing organic, is it sustainable? And she was talking about visiting with older gardeners in Anchorage, and they were still using grass and leaves to create their compost. But there's new products on the market that you can pay a lot of money to bring up here to put in the nutrients in your soil. And so, I mean, there's a lot of questions about this, and I can understand why people are confused and why they want to take classes and they want to, mm-hmm. you know, chew on it a little bit and maybe develop their own experience. So, I don't know.
So,
oh my gosh, we're out of time, guys. Thank you, everyone, for this great hour. I want to thank Cindy Carnes, Lee Wagner, Julie Riley. Next week, Charles Wolforth will be back on Hometown Alaska. He's talking about understanding Alaska's gas line options with Larry Persily. Please connect with us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Our website is alaskapublic.org. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.